Hello, this is Alex Burkett, and you are listening to the Long Game Podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with Melanie Dietzel. Melanie is the author of The Content Fuel Framework, as well as her upcoming book, Prove It. She's also the co-founder and head of marketing at The Convoy, a company whose mission it is to help small and independently owned businesses save money so they can invest more in themselves and in their communities. In the conversation, we talk about how to find and incentivize subject matter experts to write for your blog, the value of building a personal brand and audience, and how to maintain authenticity while doing so without constructing some sort of an artificial persona, and what it's like to actually write a book, including detailed steps of her process for doing so. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Melanie Dietzel.
So, I mean, like, just for some context for you, so what we're doing here at The Convoy is we're essentially a B2B marketplace for small and independent businesses. So, you know, helping them get group pricing on things. You know, if you're an independent cafe or, you know, restaurant or doctor's office, you don't get the same group rates as like a national chain. So we're just like we're a marketplace where you can opt in to group buys on equipment, you know, software, all kinds of stuff. So that's kind of what we're into. We talk a lot about like small businesses and why they're important for the economy and stuff.
I'd love to hear more about that. And you gave a good background on what The Convoy is, but can you explain more maybe about how like you came to the idea and like how you're growing it?
Yeah. So The Convoy is, you know, the original idea actually comes from one of the other co-founders. There's just four of us that founded it together. And Yasin is our CEO. He's been sort of dreaming this idea for a really long time. He grew up with a family of immigrants. So, you know, his parents were, you know, immigrated here, and he kind of saw that immigrant experience of like trying to start a business, trying to live the American dream. And, you know, he always talks about like, it was tough. It was tough for him to see, you know, feeling like he's an island. You know, when you're an independent business owner, you're not part of a chain or a franchise, like you don't have that support, and that makes it really tough. And so that's sort of something that he's been thinking about, you know, ever since he was a kid. And I wanted to try to create some technology to rectify that, to make it so that, you know, whether they're immigrants or not, like an independent small business owner should be able to have that community support, should be able to have other small business owners they can team up with to get the kind of rates that are usually reserved for, you know, the national chains. And part of why, at least why it's so important to us, is this is really at a macro level about like redistributing wealth back into our communities. Because what we know is that small and independent business owners, like the local mom and pop type shops, like they do so much more good for their community than big box stores, you know, and not to hate on any sort of like corporate charity giving programs, like please keep it up. But what we know is that like these small and local businesses, like they retain jobs better in times of high unemployment. They typically have higher paying jobs than big box stores. There's like more involvement in the community from the, you know, they're sponsoring the local Little League team, you know, like they're way more involved. And that this, like having a rich community of all these small and like unique businesses, as opposed to just chains, actually attracts more people to the region. So it's good for the local economy. Like there's just almost an endless number of benefits to having like, you know, supported small businesses in our communities. And yet, you know, they're out here struggling because they're trying to do it themselves. So that's really what we're trying to do, is just like help make that easier. And hopefully the ripple effects of that is that it's better for our communities, you know, that we start to see, you know, more thriving local communities that don't have to send all their money out to a billionaire in another state, you know?
Yeah, I grew up near a very popular tourist destination in Galena, Illinois, and it was kind of like this popular weekend spot or summer home spot for people from Chicago. And I remember when I was a kid, like they had this beautiful main street, perfectly preserved. It's always on these like lists of America's most beautiful small towns. And there's all this like Civil War kind of stuff because President Grant lived there. And then I remember, I don't know what age I was, but it was when I was a child, the Walmart came in. And I remember there just being this massive disruption and like debate and argument about like the, you know, like integrity of that small town and like the small businesses that have basically fueled the tourism. And I think that it did a good job. But like the Walmart's still there, but like the main street is completely separate and preserved. But there was definitely a fissure when that whole ordeal happened.
Yeah. And I mean, it's tough because, you know, I mean, you can't blame consumers. Like, they're in a tough position where sometimes these big chains can come in and offer like better pricing or faster delivery or, you know, other conveniences. But there's a lot of data that shows that like most consumers are willing to pay more to support a small business. Like, we feel better when we're supporting somebody's dream as opposed to just like buying from a faceless conglomerate. So, you know, the more we can make that, like, keep that main street intact and like make those options still available, I think, you know, consumers value that. Like, it's a good thing. You know, it's not, I don't, hopefully nobody's losing sleep because like there isn't a Walmart close enough, you know?
Right. So is the product itself, you mentioned the community, is it like a membership thing where people can gain advice from each other and like kind of collaborate on things? Or because you mentioned there's like discounts and deals on software and different products as well.
Yeah.
And maybe you get like bulk purchase orders or something like that. But can you explain more of like the product and the value that you're providing the small business owners?
Yeah. So more of the latter than the former. We have hopefully plans to build more of a social element to it. But right now, I mean, it's just essentially a marketplace of self-service discounts and then those occasional group buy opportunities. So the site is live. There's no charge for small business owners. It's totally free. Just theconvoy.com. If you go to our marketplace, you know, theconvoy.com/marketplace, you'll see we have like 150 plus self-service deals. So these are either like bulk discounts we've pre-negotiated, you know, special discount codes, things like that. So everything from like Zoom or like payroll software to N95 masks and safety shoes. So there's like a really wide array of stuff there. You just log on, like you just register, create a free account, and you can start using some of those discounts to help cut your expenses and give you more to like reinvest into yourself and into the community. But, you know, the group buy element is a little bit more hands-on right now. We're a fairly young company. We just launched at the start of this year. So still building and growing and learning. And what we're working on right now is just trying to identify, you know, groups of small businesses that are in the market for the same type of thing. So that might be, you know, a group of dentist offices that need a new x-ray machine, or, you know, a group of barbers who need a new set of shears, and then negotiating on their behalf to get a price down. So learning how we can do that manually and then continuing to evolve the tech to help support it.
How do you get customers? You've got to be doing content marketing, right?
Yeah, we are. So, you know, it's an interesting position. So personally, like I'm heading up marketing, but I'm also one of the founders. So I wear a lot of hats. And, you know, at different points in time, I'm sort of in different mindsets. From a marketing standpoint, we do have a blog. We have done a lot of partnership type content. So there's, you know, getting folks like from Regis, which is a company that does like office rentals,
payment.
Yeah. So Regis came in and did a guest post for us about like how to know if hybrid is the right solution for your small business. You know, we've had like social media experts come in and talk about social for small businesses. So really just trying to make it super educational and not product focused at all. The wonderful thing about what we're doing is we're not selling anything, right? Mm-hmm. We're just trying to help small businesses. And so, from a messaging standpoint, it makes it really easy because, you know, we're really just trying to add value. And that for me as a marketer is a fun mission to be like, how do we just help small businesses, like make content that helps small businesses? So that's a lot of fun from the blog side. We have a lot of other things that are kind of in the works. Like I said, we're fairly young still, and we're a lean team, so we're doing as much as is realistic for us. But we have a pretty good community growing on Instagram, which has been a lot of fun, just celebrating small businesses and the things that are important to them, and hopefully getting people to think more about small businesses too. You know, just like identifying opportunities where you could be supporting an independent as opposed to a chain or a national brand.
Do you have these partnership guest posts? Do you do your own as well? Like, do you have freelancers working on this, or are you writing guest or blog posts as well? Or like, what's the mix between people like Regis and internal writing on the blog?
So, as of right now, I'm the only person who is really focused on the blog. So it's, I do contribute to it as I can. But I am trying to fuel it mostly with outside experts. And a big part of that is because I just recognize, like, I don't know everything about running a small business, and I would much rather get outside experts in to come and share their knowledge. And in most cases, you know, folks are happy to do it. It's more again, because we're not selling anything, it's more of a partnership than like any sort of sponsored content situation. Like, it's really just finding folks who are experts in a certain area and asking them, like, would you like to share your expertise with the small business audience? And so far it's worked out really well. I think there's a lot of folks who want to reach small businesses with their expertise. So it's kind of nice to be able to share that audience with them.
Yeah, you mentioned something interesting offhand there, which was you said, out of humility, like, I don't know everything about growing a small business, so I want to get in experts, which I think is like the split that I see sometimes in content, which is like specialist produced content, subject matter expert led content, which depending on the space is very hard to get like actual like subject matter experts to write a full 2000 word article. And then doing your own kind of bespoke research and you know, it's hard to bridge that gap sometimes, but you have a journalism background. So it sounds like you naturally thought, hey, I should reach out to experts who have been doing this for 20 years. Do you credit your journalism background for that viewpoint?
You know, I hadn't thought about it until you put it that way, but I guess that is very much a mindset that I've always been in, which is like, I see it more as my job to curate information than to actually know everything. And using expert sources is a big part of that, referring people to other resources. So yeah, that to me, it just naturally made sense. It was like, I know a lot about marketing. I could talk about marketing all day, but running a small business, you know, hiring, like, you know, there's a lot to running a small business that's outside the realm of marketing. And I don't want to overstep my bounds. I would much rather, you know, it would take me hours to do research and write something with any level of authority that someone else probably knows like the back of their hand. So to me, it was just like, let's get folks who know their stuff, who want to share, and, you know, give them a chance to fill in on that platform, you know?
How do you distinguish between people who know what they're talking about and who don't, and also the ones that can actually write a full article and the ones who can't?
You know, that is a really good question.
Contributors?
You know, a lot of them are folks that ask. We're always like, if reach out to me, if you've got an area of expertise, you know, generally speaking, I like to look on who has some experience with writing. So if they have a blog, or, you know, they have a newsletter, or there's something that indicates like this person, you know, is skilled in this area and can contribute something that's going to be valuable for the audience. And also, you know, I don't want to do a ton of editing, which is not to say that I don't want to do the work, but more so that I don't want to have to like squash someone's voice or like change their intent. I would really like for them to kind of have that so that I don't have to influence that. You know, I want their voice to come through. I don't want it to be me rewriting it. You know,
so you don't have like some like top down editorial style guide where everybody's supposed to fit this homogenous voice. It's more so like a, God, I don't know, like a Atlantic or something like that, where like you can read an author like Derek Thompson, and he's got like his own unique viewpoints and voice, obviously fits 100%. Under the same format of the Atlantic, but you're not stifling that to fit some like brand kind of image across the board.
No, I mean, there's a couple of things we do for consistency just because it makes for a better user experience. Like we style a lot of them the same. So, you know, we have consistent fonts that we use, you know, we're doing the publishing of it. So that's the formatting and like the layouts. You know, we try to use a certain type of imagery that fits our brand. You know, we pull images from our library. We don't ask folks to come up with imagery, although if they have like graphics and graphs, charts, things like that, we're happy to include it. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, we have a set of like broad guidelines that of what's brand safe. I'm not asking people to write as if they are the Convoy, because their value is actually that they're from outside, like their experience, their personal stories, like their background. That's why, you know, that's why they're here. We have some like brand guidelines, just like as a rule, like we don't cuss, for example. So like, you know, if I ask folks like, don't do that, and if you do that, we're going to have to remove that. That's not on brand for us. We also, as a general rule, try not to make negative examples of people, particularly small businesses. It is so much more powerful to talk about what to do right than to sort of like tear somebody down or call someone out and say like, this is the wrong way to do things. We're really trying to have like a positive educational, you know, tone to what it is that we're doing. Like, we're here to help. And so, you know, we're not trying to bring in like, you know, trash talk or like case studies of what not to do. There's like a couple broad guidelines, but for the most part, I mean, if somebody has an idea and I think that idea is, you know, would be valuable for small business owners, then we'll find a way to fit it in.
No, I like that. Those are more broad heuristics, not necessarily like writing style tips. Cause like I see people on Twitter talking about like they're writers first and foremost. They talk about like content marketing mistakes, and it's like, well, here's the difference between an M dash and an N dash and a hyphen, and here's AP style versus Chicago style and stuff like that. Yeah. And I just think like if somebody asked me to come in and write an article about SEO or experimentation and gave me a guide that was like 5 or 6 pages of tips like that, like there's zero chance I'm going to read through that. But if I could have 3 or 4 items where it's like, here's what we adhere to, like philosophically, not necessarily like my writing style, then, oh, I can, I can not swear in an article, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly what it is. I have it to one page. That's my, I wanted it to be a one pager. It's not like densely packed. And it's an outline that includes both like, here's our process. So like, here's what to expect. Here's how to submit your article. And here are some, like you said, broad philosophical things to keep in mind, like be positive, be educational. Like we're here to help. Don't swear, please. you know, just a couple broad things, but yeah, I mean, it's, in a way I'm recognizing that, you know, because we are really mission oriented, this is not the Atlantic. We're not paying contributors, you know, like we're not able to do that given the stage of our business right now. And so I want to make it easy. I'm not trying to give you homework. I just would really like to offer the opportunity to share if you'd like to share, you know, to give that as an option. So yeah, I mean, I think that's important too. You know, we're lucky that we're at the stage of business where we're flexible on those things. I can understand, you know, some larger enterprises, they may have, you know, different types of concerns, legal concerns, you know, compliance type things they have to worry about, but luckily we can be flexible. So I'm trying to hold on to that while we can.
Yeah. So incentive wise, why does somebody want to write for the blog? You said it's like newly launched. Sorry to be blunt, but like, I always think like, what's in it for me? And a lot of people are reaching out because they want to get a backlink, right? From a high domain rating site. Sure. But if your site's new, you know, I'm guessing that their 2000 words would be better spent if they reached out to like HubSpot's blog or something like that. So how do you, it sounds like people are coming inbound to you. Like how do you get this interest drummed up from potential guest writers?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I'm really lucky, you know, I've been working in the marketing and content space for quite a long time. So the audience that I have on social media is, you know, very similar minded. And a lot of them are folks who are looking for opportunities to promote their business. One thing that we offer is, you know, our audience is small business owners, right? So, you know, if you want to reach a gigantic audience and you want to reach, you know, folks who are high up at Fortune 500s, like we're not the place for you. We can't help you with that. That's go to HubSpot for sure. And I would tell you that in a heartbeat. If you are hoping to reach small business owners that are kind of hard to reach otherwise, you know, this is a good opportunity. It is easier. There's a lot less guidelines than you might find with some of those others. But for the most part, at least what I've experienced so far is it's mostly folks who are kind of aligned with the mission. You know, folks who are like, I just want to help small businesses. Like I like to write, I like this stuff. I'd love to do 5 tips for local SEO for small businesses. Cause if I can help this business that I love locally, you know, that's what I would want to do. I do ask for the one thing I do ask that's like a request is to mention a small business in like your bio. So we have like a 1 or 2 sentence bio at the end of like who the contributor is. You're getting full credit, you know, including your portfolio, whatever. But to say like I'm a fan of and just like any small business. I don't care if it's like that does your oil change or a restaurant or whatever, and like we'll link to their site. So really, just trying to. I think it's people who are mission aligned. And if anybody is not in a place in their career, in their finances to be able to do that without pay, then I fully understand it. Like I've been on that side of things. So I recognize that like asking people to do work for free is not necessarily a place where we want to be. And so it does tend to be folks who are kind of mission oriented and see it almost like as a way to give back to small businesses. And that's fine with me.
That's awesome. I have a parallel, like when I used to work at CXL, which is like the center place for like all experimentation and CRO and, you know, technical marketing dialogue. Yeah. We would find people, you mentioned this kind of similar, like people who had social or newsletters or something like that. We would find these passionate experts, these people who were fanatics about A/B testing, who were writing on Quora and Medium and all these different websites for free. And basically pull them in to the CXL blog because they also just wanted to speak their knowledge to this audience of like-minded individuals. That was like the industry water cooler, so to speak, of people who loved experimentation and just wanted to talk about their new ideas.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have that. And I know that like for me personally, when I've like, if I'm putting myself in the opposite shoes, there's a long time where I was running my own consultancy firm before, you know, before I, before I joined the convoy. And I would often take, you know, I don't know, podcast interviews that maybe were not like a gigantic podcast, because I'm aligned with the mission. I love what we're talking about, and I feel like we're speaking the same language. Same thing for contributing a guest post. Like, even if the site doesn't have a ton of traffic, like, if these are my people and I like to talk to these people, then like, that's a fun place for me to be. So yeah, as long as you're timing it right, you know, you can't do only that kind of stuff to grow your business, you know, to grow your awareness or your expertise. But, I mean, it's nice to be able to fit stuff like that in when you can.
Yeah. I say yes all the time to illogical requests just because I like talking about this stuff.
Yeah, it's fun, me too.
Right? Like, why not?
Yeah. I joke about this all the time. My team, has given me a limit of I'm only allowed to do one podcast a week, because otherwise I would 100% just spend like hours a day talking to
folks
about content stuff. You did.
That's amazing. You mentioned a consultancy. Are you still consulting, or is it all the convoy right now, or what's your focus? What's on your desk?
Yeah,
right,
so
now?
It's all the convoy right now. So coming in as a co-founder, it's sort of like all in, for sure, all in. Mm-hmm. We're trying to make this work, doing whatever we can. And that means that, like, you know, you might think that it sounds like this glorious place to be, but it's also like, you know, I've done a lot of manual data entry late at night, you know, or like, you know, stuff that doesn't necessarily fall into the marketing budget, but it's what we need to do, or like into the marketing bucket, but it's like what we need to do to get stuff done. So to me, it's fun and it's exciting, and it's nice to be able to, like I said, having a good mission at the core of things kind of makes all of that a lot easier. Like, you know, you're doing something for good, which is a nice motivation. You don't always get that when you're marketing and you don't have control over what you're marketing. I have done work for brands that I'm not super proud of having worked for and helped to put their mission forward. And so it's nice to feel good about the work you're doing, right? That's really cool. I'm not doing consulting right now. I do still do some speaking, you know, speaking at conferences and workshops, but only when it's really like a good alignment that I'm going to be reaching the kind of folks that we want to talk to, small business owners, people in the small business space, is typically who I'm looking to speak to. And I am still, I had a book come out in 2020, and I just got the preview copies of my next book, which should be coming out later this year. So still, you know, still living the content life and loving content in the background, but trying to put it to good use.
So what's a day in the life look for you? I mean, it sounds like the book is done and you're basically in the almost launched phase. Yeah. So I imagine you're not writing regularly just on a book, but like, what, how do you partition out your day? Like, how do you spend your time?
I wish I had a good answer for you. I'm still figuring it out every single day. Mm-hmm. So added into all of this, so we just moved. We just got a new house, and I also have a toddler. So a lot of my days are dictated by her just by default. Like, I wake up, then she needs to wake up, you know, things like that. But I think as a general rule, like, we start our days at the company with a team stand up. So we have a small meeting, 30 minutes, usually less. That's everybody. And it's, what did you work on yesterday? What are you working on today? And are you stuck on anything, so that someone else could try to help? So we do that every morning, and it's a really good way to start off getting a sense of what everyone's working on, of how you might be able to plug in and help. And it kind of forces you to articulate, like, what is it that I'm going to do, and adds that accountability of like, I need to list out tomorrow what it is that I accomplished today. So I love that. Keeps everything kind of organized. But throughout the day, it's kind of a mix. I mean, I always spend a little bit of time on our social channels, whether that's like doing social listening and engaging, or checking results from a campaign, or just kind of like hanging out and doing some user research, eavesdropping on social conversations about small businesses. I typically try to spend some time on the blog, although admittedly, it's not always the top of the list. I do a lot of copy related tasks, like with other teams. So, you know, if somebody's working on a landing page for something, or, hey, we're wondering, you know, the UX team is like, what should we make this button say? Like, what would be a better call to action? So I'm kind of doing a lot of random stuff, to be honest, throughout the day. But yeah, a lot of it just comes back to that core of the messaging, the positioning, the branding. That's where most of my time is spent. And then sometime around 5:30, I pack it up and go get the little one from school. And then we're into night mode.
You did mention before that your personal brand and audience that you've built has been a big benefit to building the Convoy and at least like reaching out to your network and having those relationships. So is your personal brand, I'm sure because you've written books, your personal brand has been something you've proactively cultivated or thought about in the past?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is that something you're still focused on, is building up your own personal audience through Twitter, through LinkedIn, through different channels?
You know, it's funny. This is like a therapy session because these are all the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately. This is kind of nice.
That's what we do. All therapy in these interviews.
I am still curating that. And I think it's because in a way, like it's, I don't know that my personal brand was manufactured in any way. And I know that might sound like, I don't know, maybe that sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, but I really just care deeply about this stuff. And so it's not an effort for me to talk about content, talk about marketing. Like I am really interested. I do see cool case studies and want to share them with people. So I think just sort of like by still being me, I'm still, you know, sharing that kind of stuff, connecting with people, you know, being a part of those conversations. But yeah, there was a long time where there was more intentional effort going toward that kind of stuff. You know, I was more active, doing more podcasts, more guest posts. When I was running my own consultancy, I mean, I was, of course, always looking for new consulting clients in the content space. And I was pre-COVID, you know, when travel kind of changed things. But pre-COVID, I was doing, I don't know, probably 100 plus nights a year that I was in a hotel because I was speaking at a conference or, you know, doing a corporate offsite for someone. So I was always looking for clients. And so I tried to be really active, really present, tried to get as much sort of, you know, get my name out there as much as I could. And I generally just did that by, I tried the journalism approach of show, don't tell. So rather than like talking about myself, talking about my services, I really just tried to add as much value as I could. So that people would be like, hey, we should probably have her over to help us with that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's why I still do a little bit of that, like the speaking and stuff. But I'm hoping that I can, to some degree, just like keep providing some of that same value just by continuing to do what I'm doing. And hopefully that's still valuable for people.
Do you ever feel as you know, you're building your company, there's probably more heads down work and more tasks that rise to the level of importance. Do you ever feel like an inkling of fear that that's going to crowd out any of your personal brand building activities and you'll be less relevant or forgotten in the general sphere? Like, does that ever cross your mind with something like this?
You know, I don't think so. And I think it's because, like I said, like we're building in public, you know, so I'm still talking about those things. I'm just talking about what I'm doing at the Convoy and, you know, how I'm applying it in this new context. But also, I mean, I do love to write. Like this new book that's coming out, I'm super psyched about it. It's about how to use content to prove out your business claims. So again, still relevant, still in that content space, still useful for small businesses. And I would be lying if I said that I hadn't already started thinking about what the next one would be. Actually, it's a torturous process, but I really love the process of writing books. And so that's something that I imagine I'll continue to do on a somewhat frequent basis, you know, every couple of years. So no, I mean, I don't worry about that. I hope that I can come to embody, you know, maybe add some more of that small business spice to the brand that I have. But no, I think they complement each other really well because, like, you know, either talking about the marketing that I'm doing with small businesses or talking about the marketing that I'm doing for the company itself, there's still opportunity to have those conversations and to find the overlap there. So yeah, it's probably a slightly adapted brand. Like I'm not talking so much about what I'm doing on stage. Instead, I'm talking about, you know, what I'm doing here in the office, but, hopefully it's still interesting. We'll see. The data will tell.
I love it when they align like that. What's the most torturous part about writing a book? I've thought about writing a book myself. We're talking about it with the agency. Theoretically know that it's difficult. Like you hear about Hemingway's, like, you know, writing's easy. All you have to do is open a vein and bleed on the paper. Like these deeply dramatic quotes. But yeah, I want to hear your experience with it. You've written two, so.
Yeah. So, the first book, when I wrote my first book, I was pregnant. And so I had a very good deadline, which is like, once this kid gets here, I'm definitely not going to be able to finish writing this book. So it's got to be done by then. So that was good. It was a challenge for me on a personal level, because like, I didn't feel my best. Like I wasn't in my, you know, I wasn't physically my best self. I wasn't as like active or healthy as I would have been in the past. So it's challenging to do your best work when you're not feeling your best, of course. But, you know, we got it done. I think the biggest thing for me that time was really having a process that worked, because I think what you don't realize about a book until you're really in it is like, it's a massive undertaking. You know, mm-hmm. we're used to sitting down and writing an email or an article, and you work for 25 minutes, an hour, and you have something to show for it. When you're writing, you know, 50,000 words, like it doesn't come that fast. And it's a lot of like anguishing over things and trying to make all the pieces fit together. Like it's just a bigger animal, you know? It's kind of like, you know, when somebody runs their first marathon, you know, like you generally don't go into it without a plan and prep and like having worked, you know, to get ready for it. That this is sort of like running a marathon when you're just a casual runner, like mm-hmm. with no warning, you know? So you need to have a plan, you need to prep for it.
What is that plan and prep? I'm curious about that, because I'm like typically somebody who sits down and just writes based on like some loose idea I have, and I figure out the plan as I go.
Yeah.
But I could imagine mm-hmm. when you're writing 50, 80,000 words, like that's just not a viable way to do things.
I mean, it may be for certain sections. Like if you know what you're sitting down to write about and you want to like wax poetic for a while and then come back and clean it up later, that may work really well for you. Some folks do write that way. For me, it was about having a clear outline of what my content was. So for me, I already knew what the structure of the book would be. I knew here are the key topics that I'm going to touch on. I knew which chapters were going to go where, and each chapter needed to have a story and statistics. And, you know, it was very structured, at least for me, to know what I was working on at any given point, and to be able to break that out and say, like, in order to meet my word count, I need to do this many pieces per week. I need to finish this by this date. Like I really kind of made a training plan for myself, like to make sure I made it to the finish line, was like planning it out and having a really clear idea. When I sit down, I'm not writing my book. I'm writing chapter 7, the, you know, anecdote that opens the chapter.
So chunk it out. It's not like you're eating the whole elephant. You're taking one bite.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. So that, I mean, that's what worked for me. I know other people have other systems, but for me, knowing exactly like chunking it out and knowing like this specific part is what I'm working on now, was good. I also allowed myself flexibility that, I could work on, there were options, because sometimes I would sit down and be like, oh, I'm not feeling the data thing today. Like, I don't want to work on the numbers. Like, maybe I should just work on the anecdote instead. So there was flexibility so that I could kind of like you were saying, like follow the inspiration. Like, this is what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to write that for now. And I did write it very out of order. I didn't do it, you know, chapter one opening, you know, I did all over the place. But I tried to chunk similar types of work together so that I could like finish all the examples and make sure they were consistent, finish all the stories, you know, things like that. The other thing that's really hard, to be honest, is not getting sidetracked, because once you start writing, you start to imagine like there's a billion things you could do in that book. There's a million stories you could tell, facts you could cite, you know, research wormholes you could go down. So for me, having that plan kept me from procrastinating on the book, like, you know, just like researching for 3 hours instead of writing something or whatever. So yeah, the plan, at least for me, was like a really key part of it. And I implemented a similar version of that for writing the second one. And it definitely made it way more manageable. But I think it's also like, because of the size of the project, For most people who are like professionals who are also writing a book, like it's not your actual job. Like you remember, like people write books as their job, their full-time thing. Mm-hmm. Like they spend all their time doing it. And we're trying to squeeze that in between, you know, work and taking care of yourself and getting groceries and picking up the kids and, you know, taking the dog out for a walk. Like it's a lot to fit in. And so there are definitely times, like if you don't have a plan, if you haven't like put that time on your calendar to work on it, it's very easy for it to drag on a lot longer than you expect, because it's so easy for it to get pushed out in, you know, in the grand scheme of everything else you have going on in life. It's a lot of work. But I enjoy the work. It's good. Mm-hmm. I like writing. So You just have to find a way to like work it into your life, because it's not going to happen by accident, you know?
What time of the day did you write?
It was different all the time. I think it, for me, it was more like when could I have the brain space? So it was less about a specific time of day and more about what was going on that day. So like if I was doing a ton of creative work in the morning, then I probably know like I'm going to be a little mentally spent by the end of the day, because I already exerted a lot of that creative energy. If I was doing a lot of mindless tasks, like, I don't know, like updating invoices, you know, something that didn't require as much creative energy, I knew I could fit in a good writing session because I would still have that. So it varied. It was really based on the calendar, but I tried to to put it in a place where I knew I would have the energy to do it, like the mental and the right mindset, if that makes sense.
So not 15 minutes before your next meeting, trying to squeeze in like a little writing.
That's the other thing. Yeah, you do need a deep work time. And I know that that's really tough to carve out sometimes. But yeah, I would basically, if it wasn't an hour, I wouldn't consider it productive. I would do something else that's book related, you know, look for resources or work on citations or something. Because like the writing stuff, it's just, at least for me, it's hard to get into a flow that quickly and really get enough done to be worthwhile.
Nice. I have a question that might be a little esoteric, but hopefully this makes sense. So it's kind of between like the sense of emergent originality and inspiration. So I'm sure you read all the time, like nonfiction, fiction, you know, you probably got a big breadth of books that you've read from. So you mentioned that you knew the structure of the book that you were going to write before you started writing it. And I'm curious how much of that was a reflection of inspiration that you've consciously constructed. So saying like, you know, I like Malcolm Gladwell because he starts each chapter with some sort of an anecdote that catches your attention. Or I like Nassim Taleb because he creates these like terms, you know, that like the black swan that just stick and kind of summarize a whole concept, versus how much of that was just, you know, a product, an emergent product of your personality and kind of your just embedded inclinations, like inspiration versus just putting your stuff on paper as you.
That's really interesting. So my first book was based on actually a workshop that I had given many times. So the structure had kind of evolved over time. You know, the structure for the book was taken largely from that workshop, and I was just trying to make it more accessible in book form. So that was a gift for me that I had actually spent several years working on and kind of like refining the structure and knowing the order that works well to present that kind of information. But yeah, there were certain things like as a journalist, honestly, I like those. I really like those authors who bring in the evidence. Like that's something that's important to me. So whether that is stats or expert quotes or something like that, that was important to me. So I made it I had to include certain statistics. Like I wanted statistics or evidence of some kind to be present throughout the book. I know that when you're talking about the first book was about generating content ideas. It's a very intangible topic, right? There's not much to point to or hold in your hand for this kind of topic. So I knew that tangible examples were going to be key. And folks like Malcolm Gladwell do a really good job of that, of like giving an example in a tangible form to kind of like give life to a concept. That was another thing where it was like, I need a ton of tangible examples for everything that I'm talking about here, so people understand from, you know, the concept theory to actual execution.
You implant it in the memory. You give them some sort of a totem that represents that fully fleshed out idea in the chapter in like a single anecdote, like Malcolm Gladwell's hockey players describing like the benefits of being born. So you're like older in your given class, right? Like I just think of the hockey players now, and you know, that was probably a 20-25 page chapter.
Yeah. So that kind of thing I think is really important. And in my upcoming book, I did very much what you're just talking about. I opened the chapters with an anecdote to kind of show like, you actually know this, like you understand this. It's just, you probably haven't thought about it or labeled it in this way. But I think honestly, what I focused most on for the first book, because the content, it was already in my head. Like I had already given this workshop probably 200 times. Like I already knew all the content. It was really just getting it onto paper. What I was focused on, and I'm not sure specifically which authors this was drawn from, is I wanted it to be really approachable. Like I wanted it to be simple and clear and have white space. I didn't want it to be intimidating. Like I wanted it to be simple. Maybe like Phelan Jones' book, Exactly What to Say, is one of a book like that. Like it's very You know, there's white space. It's very clear. It's very well organized. So I was trying to follow a similar structure like that to just make it so that you could use it as a reference and easily find what you're looking for. And that it wasn't packed with fluff just to increase a word count. The other thing I did, which I really enjoy, I wanted my personality in there, but I didn't want it to be a distraction. And I am a person who does like humorous asides, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so I did that in the form of footnotes. So there's a lot of footnotes throughout the book where it's like,
it's my favorite,
just like a little, yeah, like an aside.
It's
like
my ADHD brain just the perfect way. It's like, oh, here's a little distraction. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, like just like little facts, like I gave an example around like a sports team, and I used the UConn women's basketball team. And so the footnote was like, hey, by the way, like, you know, I am from Connecticut. UConn women's basketball is like our professional sports league. Like this is, you know, my mom had this bumper sticker that said like UConn, where men are men and women are champions. Like, you know, just kind of like these funny little like bringing myself into it and like explaining the backstory of things, or
that's good
for
writing.
Me was like,
more people should do that.
Yeah, I felt like, you know, like we're reading this is a nonfiction book. It's like self-improvement / you know, tactical how to do this kind of marketing stuff, but like we're also people, and like I don't talk like a robot. If I were talking to you in person, I would be telling these little asides and I'd be joking with you and we'd be having more of an exchange. So I wanted it to just feel a little more human. And I think that was one of the like best calls that I made, because when someone sends me an email that references one of those footnotes, I'm like, you really read it, mm-hmm. you know, like you were there. We were in this together, you know.
I specifically love doing that across all of my content and my newsletter, on social, on blog posts, because you get all outreach all the time if you've got any sort of personal brand, and most of it's generic mm-hmm. and it sucks. But I love it when somebody references my love of the Wisconsin Badgers, or you know, 90s punk rock or something like that, that I just like layered in some article from a long time ago, or my about page or something like that. That's why I think, you mentioned before, not curating your personal brand very proactively and not constructing it, mm-hmm. manufacturing it. I think there's benefits if you're the type of person who can do that, like Neil Patel, right? Pretty constructed brand, but the brands that I like following are the ones that kind of bleed out into like adjacent topics and other interest areas. Yeah. Like they just add a more full picture of the person behind the tweets. And I couldn't do it any other way. It sounds like you couldn't do it any other way either. To me, it would be just so boring to stick in your lane and just write the facts, you know?
And the thing that I have a hard time with is like, I think what I think about a lot, and this may have come from the speaking stuff, is like, I'm going to meet some of these people in person and they're going to see who I am. And if I'm not this person that I've constructed, like that's going to be bad for everybody all around. Like one thing that's probably, there are a lot of people whose like personal image, like, you know, the makeup, the hair, the outfits, like are very, very curated. Like there's a lot of intentionality there. Like I'm literally wearing a conference t-shirt right now. I'm wearing like jeans, like, but that's, if you see me at the airport, if you see me at a conference, like that's what I look like. So I don't want, I could get all done up and do a photo shoot, but like, that's not what I look like. You won't recognize me in person.
It kind of weirds me out when somebody has like a shtick too, that they're like, all right, I'm the guy who wears this kind of a hat. It's fine if you were the person that actually does that. But when you're like, all right, limiting. This is who I have to be thought of when I'm on stage. Like I have to have this, this brand stamp, you know?
Well, you know, and it kind of brings me back. Like I get why some people do it. If you're trying to reach a specific audience and they have expectations, like, I'm not in the finance industry. If I was in the finance space, nobody would probably take me seriously because I'm not wearing a suit and I'm not like, you know, you have to know your audience, right?
Or maybe you stand out because of that, right? Maybe everybody else looks the same. So then it's like, oh, this person is confident in some way or standing out. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think for me, it comes back to like, I don't know, you know, when you're little and your parents give you like those life lessons that are like, you roll your eyes at them as a kid. And then as an adult, you're like, dang it, they were right. One of the things my mom used to always say is, if you don't lie, you don't have to remember what you said. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, that has stuck with me where it's like, I do sometimes, if I were going to a conference, like I would be sitting in the airport terminal and somebody who was there at the conference would come up to me. I don't want to have to change who I'm being. Like, I don't want to have to like put that face on or worry that like I didn't wear enough makeup to the airport, you know, like I just want to be myself. And then I don't have to worry about like who I'm seeing where. If you run into me at Target, you run into me backstage at the conference, you run into me like here in the co-work, I'm still me. I'm the same person. And that makes it a lot easier, you know, cause I don't have to, I can just be myself living my life and share observations there. And I'm, you know, sharing my brand as an outcome of that.
Do you naturally think like that? Have you always thought like that? Or is this a product of therapy? Because for me, it's the latter. This idea that, oh, you could just show up as yourself and people will be fine with that.
No, I haven't always. I mean, I think some of that, I don't know that it was therapy so much as just like growing up. Like I think when I first started in, so when I was 24, I got a job at the New York Times as the first ever editor of branded content. And when I tell you there was hardly enough room at my desk because of all the imposter syndrome in that office, like it was crazy. Cause I recognized like these people have kids my age and I'm making like business decisions that, you know, it's like, it was definitely, there was imposter syndrome. And, I was wearing like, blazers and like, you know, it's like suit jackets to work. And one day my boss actually, like, to his credit, like came over and he was like, dude, when I interviewed you, you were wearing Converse and jeans. Like, you know, you could still do that here. Like, you don't have to be somebody else. Like, just be yourself. Like, you don't need a blazer to be taken seriously. And like, that was probably one of the best gifts that he could have given me, because it was like permission. Like, you don't have to dress up as what you think this person should be. Like, just be yourself. And God, that makes life so much easier, because you don't have to divert all this energy to acting or, you know, costume or, you know, whatever else. Like, you could just do your job. So yeah, no, it wasn't always like that. I think, some of it was just growing into your skin and like feeling more comfortable and assured of yourself. But the other thing, I'll be totally honest, is like, some of it is like when the bad stuff happens and the world doesn't end and you realize like you were maybe overthinking or over worrying about something. At least that's how it happens for me. Like I used to be very, like, honestly, like very self-conscious, and I would want to have like a full face of makeup if I was doing like video stuff. One time there was like a schedule change and I didn't, and I was like, that still went fine. Like, it still went well. I felt fine. The outcome was the same. That's not something that I need to be so, so concerned about all the time. Like, ideally, should we, like, you know, make sure that we have, you know, that we look the way we want to look, that we feel confident? Yeah. But it's not the end of the world. Like, I don't need to stress about it as much as I thought. I had a similar revelation about like what I wear when I'm on stage. I thought similarly, like a speaker, like that's like, you know, there's a look, there's the blazer and the, you know, the heels and like all this stuff, but like, that's not who I am. And I don't feel confident when I'm wearing that costume. So, you know, now I go up and I wear, either boots or I wear, you know, my Converse, and I'm wearing jeans 100% of the time. Like, it just is what it is. Like, that's where I do my best work, and I'm not here to take a nice picture. I'm here to deliver value, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, like, how often I have the conversation in, I don't know whether it's like an age thing or like a generation thing or like a marketing specific thing, but how many of us, especially early in our careers, operated out of what is tantamount to anxiety and fear. Cause this is something that my co-founders and I have discussed ad nauseum on our Kitchen Side episodes, which is like, you know, I kind of always felt like I was going to get fired from all my jobs. Like, there was just this impending sense of like the other shoe was going to drop. And like, yeah, I had the same things where like I had to be and act a certain way. And yeah, I don't know what the cause is, but it does. I wonder sometimes if people who are like accountants, you know, go through this. Like, I wonder if it's a marketing thing. Because we're so like maybe obsessed everywhere. With perceptions and like how people are viewing brands, and we're trying to construct something. Like, maybe we, you know, position some of ourselves onto that too. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'm sure some of it is just like the brain leakage, like going from the professional side of like having objectives and worrying about perception and, you know, all those things. I'm sure it leaks into the personal side of things. But I think people do have that in other areas, because I know there are like, you know, startup founders talk often, if you can get them to be candid, about like feeling insecurity, feeling like, you know, imposter syndrome, you know, why should investors, you know, like those kind of feelings.
In that space, it's even more, maybe like less talked about, but Andy Johns, who I admire a lot, even from his growth days, started writing about mental health. Yeah. And sure enough, like there's a ton of comments on his Twitter thread and his Substack posts about this. And it's like, yeah, I'm a high achiever. And it's been because of this perfectionism and this like feeling that I derive value or I show value for myself by achieving. And it's like when you, mm-hmm. when you open up, especially high achievers, I think there's actually a lot under the surface in that particular crowd.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and then you add in like we're talking about the way that like, you know, your brand defines you and, you know, it has everything to do with it. Yeah. It's like a recipe for anxiety.
100%. So back to the book, did you write this to get clients or like, was there a specific purpose that you wrote it for or it's a hard thing to do? You
know? Yeah, no, you know, it's funny because it kind of ties into like what I'm doing now. So I guess maybe just like underscoring that, like I'm the same person. You know, I had this moment. I was on the road. I was doing like doing conference and workshops and stuff. And I realized like, I'm only talking to the same kind of people. I'm talking to people who are at like super successful companies that have enough money to bring in, you know, an outside speaker for a corporate offsite, or folks who have the time and the resources to take a day off and pay $2,000 to go to a conference, maybe fly across the country and do it. And it was just this moment of like, that is so not the majority of people who need this information. It is so not the majority of like, it's not representative. And recognizing that, you know, I still need to make a living to like, you know, have a place to live. I couldn't just stop doing all of those things, but I wanted to do something that would make all of that, like democratize it essentially. Like I wanted to make it more accessible. And so I thought about a lot of things. I thought about a course. I thought about an ebook, about just the workbook version of what I do in the workshops. And ultimately I felt like the book was the best answer because I wanted to keep it low price. So it's not hardcover. It's only, you know, paperback. We kept it below $15, you know, trying to make it as accessible as possible, and make it something that's a resource. That's like, you buy this and you keep it because you can go back and you can reference something and you can refer back to it. So it was sort of like the way I felt like I could pack the most value at the lowest price, to make it as accessible as possible for folks who are, you know, for students, for small business owners, nonprofits. Like there's a lot of folks who probably wouldn't be in a position to have the resources to be in one of those rooms with me. And so I wanted to bring that room to them as best I could. And at the time the book just seemed like the best way for me to do that. And some of that probably comes from the fact that like my background is writing. So I would rather write a whole book than film 3 videos, I guess.
I was imagining that too, this background in journalism. And did you study journalism or English or something like that in university?
I did. So my undergrad, I studied investigative reporting. So general reporting, but I like to joke about this because it's like, it kind of dates me, but I think it's really funny. I literally took a class called computer assisted reporting. So that's what we're talking about. That's what I was dealing with. I took I focused on investigative, where like your job is to find out the answers to things and then convey that answer to people in a way that's palatable. You know, take that 6-week investigation or that 100 hours with the data and make it into 500 words or something. So I really liked that aspect. And then I went and got my graduate degree from Syracuse in arts and cultural criticism. And that was an intentional choice because I realized I had all this like hard data and numbers and science, but I wanted to make sure I was well-rounded enough to also have conversations about the arts, about culture, about society. You know, I wanted to make sure it wasn't all science and no arts, because you have to be able to have a wide range to do this kind of work. So
is this studying things like deconstructionism and postmodernism and Freudian analysis of text and art I don't know, like, are you taking multiple angles at kind of deconstructing things?
Yeah, a little bit. What mine involved, the way that I structured it, because it was a little bit of a choose your own adventure style, is I took introductory level classes in a bunch of different arts. So like a class on dance, a class on theater, a class on classical music, you know, a bunch of different things like that, so that I had at least the basic language to understand and to know what I didn't know in a bunch of different areas. And then I took a lot of really advanced writing courses where we were doing the kind of thing you're just talking about, like deconstructing things. And there were, you know, workshopping your writing with other writers and just sort of really in depth, like analyzing things, and some art classes, things like that. It was a very heady. Like, I don't know. It was a very like in your head kind of thing where you're doing a lot of thinking and analyzing it. Yeah. It was a lot of fun for sure.
I really miss that. As soon as I retire, I might just take some like college credits in those English seminars where you can, you know, go debate esoteric stuff that has zero real world bearing, and you could just, you could just have those discussions. Have could do a book club, I suppose.
Take a class. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you could audit one.
Yeah.
So underneath all of this, I try to put together threads, and like, you've got a thread of small business and passion for small business owners. You've definitely got the writing and creation, content creation, journalism. And I would say like, it sounds like you're pretty passionate about education in general. Like, it sounds like that's been a throughput of a lot of this, this content and the work you're doing with Convoy. So this is kind of a grandiose question, but, what's your long game? Like, what's the why behind this, and like, where is it bringing you?
Yeah. So I'm going to rewind before I project forward. 100%. You picked the right thread there. Education is something that's really close to my heart, really important to me. I was a first generation college student, and I was able to do that only because I received a scholarship. And so I feel really blessed, really grateful that I was able to do that. But I do feel a sense of responsibility. Like, I know that I was lucky, and that there's a million other timelines where I wouldn't have been as lucky, and plenty of people who aren't, right? And so I do feel like I want to use what I was given to give back and to share what I know. It's just, I mean, yeah, that's 100% part of the drive, is making sure that like, knowledge that stays in my head is really useless. Like, the only reason to have all of this is to share it with other people, at least in my mind. I don't know if everyone feels that way, but like, I'm not trying to have a museum. Like, I'd much rather share it with other people, you know, of just like a bunch of information in my head for what. So yeah, education is a big part of it. I don't know that I have sort of like a master long game. I have tried very hard to approach like my life and my career in terms of a flexibility. As long as I'm aligned on my core values, I have taken a lot of twists and turns that I never could have predicted. So I'm trying to just stay close to those things, right? Like, am I giving back? Am I using my writing skills and talents because that's what I love to do? And yeah, am I helping other people? And so I don't know what that long game is. I've done some college teaching. I enjoyed that. I did some course development for colleges. I enjoyed that. I've done all kinds of, you know, sort of adjacent things. And I think hopefully I'll keep saying yes to as many of those things as I can, and see where it brings me.
So that idea of the knowledge being trapped in your brain versus shared outwards is interesting to me, because I would expect, I don't think a lot of people would say this out loud, but I think a lot of people accumulate knowledge as if it's a trade secret, or if it can give them an edge towards success or some sort of understanding, and sharing would actually dilute that for them. I'm maybe putting this in, I don't know if people would actually say it like that, but I would imagine that's pretty common in terms of views, but your view is not like that. So can you, could you describe like the feeling of how you feel when you share knowledge, like, or like, what does that give to you that you're not getting from, you know, simply accumulating for your own kind of motivation and purpose?
I don't know that I've ever deconstructed it that deeply, but I think it comes back to helping. It's like, if I can, it's like, I guess it's, I see like a gift maybe. I don't know. That maybe sounds like I'm full of myself, which is not the goal here. But like, if I can walk away from a conversation knowing like, wow, I made their life easier, or I helped them find a way to save money, and that's going to be good for their family, or, you know, oh, with this thing that I share with them, like, hopefully they'll be able to get more customers. Like, to me, that's like a much better impact, you know, like I want to see that I'm making a difference. And so, I think sharing, it's like the teach a man to fish analogy, I guess, like, if I'm the greatest fisherman in the world and I'm sitting alone on a boat and other people are starving, like, that's the worst possible scenario I can think of. Like, I would much rather, like, I don't fish, so this analogy is going to go south pretty quick, but like, I would much rather run like a fishing school and like teach lots of people to fish so that they can all fish and provide for their families and like eat healthy, you know, like that to me is just way more rewarding. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know necessarily like the building blocks of that, but that is where I get my fulfillment, is knowing that I'm helping people.
Well, you mentioned the university experience and the opportunity and being grateful for that. And did you have other sort of opportunities or mentors who you felt like gave you a chance or an opportunity or taught you something along the way? I could see that being something that would influence like your inclination to do the same for others.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, going back to when I'll open up, I'm horrible at math. Like the numbers are not my thing. Right. And so when I was in high school, like I struggled with that. I was acing, you know, my English classes, my history classes, but like numbers have always been a struggle. And unfortunately, when I got to my senior year, that meant that I was blocked out of some of the courses I wanted to take because I had, you know, this black mark, this scarlet letter of my math grade. And so I had a teacher who really advocated for me and was like, look, I know we have this, but this person is clearly capable of doing this level of work and should be, you know, like I'm willing to do the exception, like let me sort of vouch for them, take responsibility, that she should be allowed to do these more advanced like writing courses and AP courses. That worked out for the best. Like I'm sure that is in no small part, like why I was able to get the scholarship and go to college. But I think it is like people who just kind of like, you know, there's a couple of teachers like that who kind of took a chance and pushed me in the right direction that I'm really grateful for. Another one is a professor my freshman year of college who told me that I was in the wrong major, and he was 100% right. And that's the reason I went into journalism. I took a class about the media, as just an elective, like learning about media, like a general communications requirement. And at the end of the semester, he was like, the questions that you ask, like, this is not an elective for you. Like you care about this stuff. You're interested in this stuff. Like, what are you doing over there in the English department? Like, you're going to read old dead guy books? Like, are you going to, like come do some fun stuff over here? That like changed the course of my life. Just someone who was paying enough attention, to kind of push me in the right direction.
It's funny what a difference it can make in somebody's life, like the vast delta in the trajectory when you simply have like one or two people who believe in you and can give you honest truths.
Yeah.
Like, did you watch the Kanye West documentary with his mom?
I did not,
being like
not
this
yet.
Fully supportive, passionate fan. And like, you could see how much he like leaned in on that support and like drew from it inspirationally to keep moving forward. It's crazy. Like you just kind of need like one or two. And like, that's sometimes a teacher or sometimes like a family friend, but it's just like seeing you and like paying attention and actually believing in your, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And I can trace like a trail of teachers who have kind of like given that little push in the right direction that kind of like got me, you know, roundabout way to where I am. But I think as we're talking about it, like that's some of what I'm doing with the content education stuff that I'm doing. And it's that it breaks my heart to hear people say like, I'm not creative. I'm not a creative person. Like I can't come up with ideas. I'm not a writer, because like I don't cuss. I want to right now, but I don't like, it's just, it's such garbage. Like it's a bad, it's like society has made you believe that you cannot do something that is so inherent to you as a human being. And taught you that it's out of your reach. And like, that's horrible. Like there is such innate creativity in all of us. We all think this way. My best example that I always give is like, you don't think you come up with good ideas, but how many ways have you thought of something going wrong?
Mm-hmm.
You've got a million different scenarios of how wrong things could go. Your brain is good at this. You just have to give it a different prompt. And so like, I feel really strongly about this because it would drive me nuts when people were like, oh, you have so many like good, how do you come up with content ideas? I'm like, it's not special. Like, it's just, you just need to know how, like, let me teach you. And so I think, some of it is that it's like, if somebody could walk away from that workshop or that, you know, that experience and be like, wow, like I can do this. Like, man, that's like the best difference you can make for someone is to like help them believe something about themselves. That's going to like push them forward in the right way. Maybe that's like a lofty goal. But I think a lot of it is like knowing that if someone can walk away feeling like, wow, I am creative, I can access this type of thing, I can do this. That could change their business. It could change their life. It could change their relationship. There's a lot of possibility if you can kind of like crack that facade and help them access that creative part of themselves.
I think that's one of the most important things you could do for somebody actually is expand their view of what is possible and what is achievable. Cause I find, yeah. I mean, I grew up in a small town where there wasn't a ton of just, you know, diverse, like the business owner in town was like the person who owned the gas station. Right. And then I went to college yeah. and saw friends doing really cool stuff. And now some of those companies have turned out to be like, you know, billion-dollar companies. And I'm like,
yeah,
I drank with those guys in college. or, you know, just like seeing what is possible and expanding your scope and believing that through, I think that's one thing is like seeing what's possible. But then the other thing that you mentioned was empowering somebody to believe that they could achieve it. Not like delusionally, right? Like not saying just like, oh, no. If I believe it, I can manifest it. But you mentioned creative output, but there's also this idea that some people are good and some people are bad at math. And I'm pretty sure Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this. It's not true. In certain cultures, like there's this growth mindset belief. No, because like I totally get it. Like I thought I was bad at math for a long time, but like in languages too. Like you know, I learned Spanish, but before then I thought I never could. And what I learned is it's really just like putting time and pressure to the problem. And after a certain amount of time, like eventually it clicks for you. Yeah. But a lot of people are put off because they don't click right away. You know, there's probably an inclination towards some of these things, just mindset wise, but if you teach somebody what is possible and to say like, hey, you can do this too. You just have to put in the time and effort. That's so empowering.
That's a good way. I'm going to try to phrase it that way. Like I've not put in the time and effort to be effortlessly skilled at math.
and it doesn't have to be a priority either, right? Like you can't be good at everything. So it's like, no, I'm choosing not to prioritize math because I want to be good at writing or what, you know, you can't pick them all.
Well, and there's something really freeing about that too. Like if you can apply that to your personal life, that's something that I've been working on like the last couple of years is instead of just saying I'm too busy, like I'm not too busy. I'm choosing not to prioritize that. Mm-hmm. Like it's like a way of holding yourself accountable, you know, and being able to when I, like you mentioned before, we get a lot of requests. They're not always reasonable. And for a long time it was, I'm too busy for that right now. I can't do that right now. I can't take that on. And the truth is I could, but this doesn't align with my priorities. And it feels much better to be able to say that truthfully, because if you just say you're busy, I mean, then they're going to ask you again in 6 weeks or 6 months, you know, and the same thing will be true. It still won't be aligned with your values. It still won't be something that's a priority for you. So, I found that to be freeing on the like busy, you know, side of things to just be honest and say like, this is not something I'm prioritizing right now.
It's great to consciously do that. I think the essence of things, words we say like commitment and even strategy or focus, like the essence of those is predicated on the fact that you're consciously choosing to close other doors. You know, if you don't consciously do so, some of those things can seep in and steal the commitment or the focus or the strategic priorities. But as soon as you consciously say like, I'm choosing this, you are by nature saying, I'm not choosing a bunch of other things, at least for now.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you have to make room for the yeses in your life by some no's for sure.
Totally. What frustrates you about the content marketing space right now? About the state of content marketing?
Oh man. God. I don't know. I think there's a couple things, but these are maybe not what you're looking for. I still get really frustrated when I see people saying that I can't do content marketing or I don't have the time. I don't have the resources. I'm not good at this. That is such a bummer to me because it's like, I know that there's so much opportunity there and it's not as elite or like, you know, exclusive as it seems. So that drives me nuts. And I always will try to fix that. The other thing I rail against this all the time. And I don't know if this is content marketing or just like a belief, but it's this thing in the space that we feel like we have to be everywhere and doing everything. Like I got to be active on every platform and I got to be hosting a Clubhouse and a Twitter space and like posting 10 times a day on TikTok. Like this kind of like Gary V hustle porn strain productivity, which like no disrespect. I worked for one of Gary's in advising and investing firms. Like the dude has hustle like no other. But he does have a big team that's helping him to achieve all of these things. And I think for a lot of people, solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, like recent grads, there's this incredible feeling of incompetence that you can't do that because all you have to do is work harder. And that it like implies that the only difference between success and non-success is how hard you work. And there's so much else that goes into that. There's like the support around you. There's the resources that you have. There's the fact that like you may be dealing with things in your life, like health issues or family issues that others aren't. Like there's so much that goes into success, and it's not purely the amount of hours you put in. And the same is true with content. Like just because you post 1,000 times a day or everywhere, like doesn't mean that it's going to be successful. You can actually be successful with less frequent content. You know, I remind people like Game of Thrones, they had us all waiting a year and a half for another season. And those episodes were as long as a movie, and we still waited and we still liked it. Right. Like you don't, if you do something worth waiting for, you don't have to do it every minute of every day. It's just, I find it exhausting. Maybe it's just more me personally.
No, it's
but
me
like
too.
That whole,
but it's
that
like, what do you like doing like, too? Right. Like, what do you, cause Gary Vee yeah, seems like yeah. he likes doing this. And it's like, when I was, we were chatting about new ways that we could kind of promote our podcast or like get more of an audience. Yeah. And the idea came up to do TikTok, cause that's like an emerging platform. Right. And yeah. I'm like, I don't want to do TikTok videos. It's not how I want to spend my time. Even if I yeah. could get more business value from it, don't want to do it. So yeah. it's one of those things you have to ask yourself too. Like, because if you're straining, if you are stressed out on one of these platforms, like you're not going to be as good as somebody who loves it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I always say too, like it's better to be awesome in two or three places than to be mediocre in 12 places. Like it just, you're spreading yourself so thin, like you're spreading your results that thin too, you know? The other thing is, just to your point there, like I could do it, but I don't want to. Another thing I remember that my mom told me when I was younger is like, you could be a good cashier at, you know, McDonald's, but that doesn't mean you should do it. Like just because right. you physically can do something doesn't mean that it's the thing you should do. And it kind of comes back to that, like saying no to things. Like, could I do fun stuff on TikTok? Yeah, probably. But am I willing to like say no to all these other things, to put in the time, to learn how to edit, to, you know, to, it's just, it's a lot more than I'm willing to prioritize right now.
I'm going to take this a little deep. There is this beautiful art. We'll see where this goes. There's this beautiful immersive art exhibition in Miami called Super Blue. Mm-hmm. And the last piece of it, you're kind of immersed in interacting with the art. So it changes yeah. as you and the other people in the room change. And the last piece yeah. is this mirror room. And it mm-hmm. goes through like the multiplicities of life. It's kind of like, it's a metaphor for like the bifurcations that you can take on different pathways. And you yeah. look through this mirror maze and there's all these, you know, different people and you see them from different angles and you start to think like,
yeah.
what if my life went this way or that way or this way? And you can kind of yeah. get frozen in all these potentials to think like, yeah, even with marketing channels, like I could be on Reddit, I could be on Quora, like I could do this or that. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you like get overwhelmed with all of these possibilities, you end up diluting your attention, feeling guilty
yeah.
and not living the one life or picking the one thing that you could have picked and actually done well. So it's kind of a trap yeah. to think of this like endless optionality.
Yeah, well, and I make a lot of analogies because, again, I think like when we start to get into this intangibles, it's sometimes hard to like to fully wrap your head around it. And I think of it like being in the kitchen. Like you could cook 10 meals at once, but you're definitely going to burn some stuff and you're going to probably cut your finger because you're rushing to chop. You know, like there is diminishing return at a certain point where you're not actually getting more done. You're just like doing what you are doing worse.
Yeah, maybe just try to make a really good salmon and then the next night just make one. Something different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Focus on the one thing at a time and be satisfied with that salmon. Yeah
and if it's not good, you cook something else tomorrow.
Totally. We're pretty much at time. I think that's an interesting ending. Well, actually, here, before I ask you to like share your online stuff, is there anything yeah. we missed that we didn't talk about that you want to bring up?
I don't think so. No, we covered a whole lot.
Stuff we could never have predicted before, which I love about these.
Yeah,
thanks so much for doing this. Can you share where people can find you online and your books?
For sure. So if anyone,
tell about your books.
So if anyone's like a solopreneur, small business owner, entrepreneur, definitely check out theconvoy.com. You can learn all about how we're helping small businesses, get some free resources. Definitely worth checking out. If you want to find me, I'm on your social platforms of choice, usually as M Diesel or Melanie Diesel. I'm the only one of me, so you'll find me if you look for me. I spend most of my time on Twitter, though. So if you want to hang out and engage, that's where you should look for me, on M Diesel on Twitter. And my website is storyfuel.co. So story FUEL.co. And that's like a good repository for contact info for all the projects I'm working on, for the books, everything.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me share my story.